Safety Committee. Oh, now we're recording. I call to order the CVAC Public Safety Committee meeting. I'm Mayor Pro Tem Wayman Furman from the City of Indio. I will be chairing this meeting. And if you want to join from the public, instructions are on the agenda. You could join via Zoom and also on your phone. So moving along, I will ask for a roll call, please.
Thank you, Chair. Aguacaliente, City of Blythe, City of Cathedral City.
Present.
City of Coachella.
Present.
City of Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
City of Indian Wells.
Present.
City of Indio.
Present.
City of La Quinta.
Present.
City of Palm Desert. City of Palm Springs, City of Rancho Mirage.
Present.
And the County of Riverside is here while we're promoting him from the attendee panel. But for the record, Juan Perez is here.
Great, thank you. So before we move on to the pledge, I just want to say a couple of words as we just, commemorated the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and going through the tragedies of our country and locally affecting us. I hope our pledge and moving forward, we are united and stronger together. So if I could have you join me by placing your right hand over your heart and saluting our flag as I lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. And now I'd like to ask us all to have a moment of silence and pay homage to our 13 soldiers we lost in this terrible tragedy, and our local native son, Hunter Lopez. And after the moment of silence, I'll have some details on some of the services that's in front of us if our public or some of our committee would like to attend. So please bow your head. Thank you. Whew. And now is the next item on the agenda is public comment. This time is set aside for members of the public to address the Public Safety Committee on agenda items. And staff, do we have any public comments, email or in the public?
Oh, we did not, Chair, but I would note for the record that the City of Palm Springs has entered the meeting as well. Councilmember Gardner.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Gardner.
Good morning.
The next item on the agenda is comments from staff, committee members, and the chair. So I would ask staff if there's any comments from staff.
I'll also defer to Councilmember Gardner here. I wanted to introduce to all of you the City of Palm Springs. As you recall, at your last meeting, said farewell to Chief Reyes for his retirement, and they have named Acting Chief Melissa Damaris, who is here. We are going to invite her to join us, I believe, as well. Councilmember Gardner, if you wanted to say anything as well.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here at our first full meeting where I'm representing the City of Palm Springs. But we're really excited to have Chief Damaris leading this city. I know it's temporary, but we're very excited for her to be here and following Chief Reyes, who we will definitely miss. So Chief, it's all you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the welcome. I look forward to joining this meeting and hearing from everybody here.
Good morning, Chief. Great to have you with us and great to have you join us. And looking forward to doing some work with you. I'll be reaching out. And so committee members, do we have any comments?
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. I know that you alluded to the services that you're going to mention here in just a minute, but I know that we're going to have a lot of traffic, probably traffic issues going throughout the various cities. And I just would request the public that is out there that may be listening, please be patient with us over the next few days as we have these services for our fallen hero. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to welcome Chief Damaris from Cathedral City, being neighbors to the west. Looking forward to meeting you soon. I know you probably met our Police Chief Crum by now, and he's doing an excellent job, and you'll find working with him. He's a terrific organizer and a motivator to our team here. We're happy to be working with you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Great. I have a hand up by Mr. Reyes. Mr. Perez, Riverside County.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to join you today. I'd like to provide a quick update to the committee on behalf of the county regarding the recent power outage as a result of a significant storm that we had out in the North Shore area, and to let you know some of the efforts going on related to that. We had another very significant storm the evening of Monday, August 30th. Initially, we had about 1,400 customers that lost power about 7:30 p.m. By the next early the next morning, about half of the customers that had power restored by IID. So we still had close to 700 customers that were without power, and it was estimated that that would last 3 to 4 days. Our Riverside County Emergency Management Department mobilized an incident management team on behalf of the county to do a number of activities. One was to have our county transportation department work on clearing roads, the mud and debris that had accumulated. We were able to open up the North Shore Yacht Club as a cooling center that same day, and IID also provided a generator to assist with that, and the cooling center was open throughout the day. IID also provided ice and water at the cooling center location. We had assistance, and I want to thank the Salvation Army as well for providing meals. They provided meals 3 times a day through a number of local vendors. And I want to thank our vendors for helping with that. The county also worked with the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians to open a mass care shelter at the Fantasy Springs Event Center. So again, our thanks to our tribal partners. We work with Catholic Charities to provide food distribution also on September 1st. And we also were able to work with IID to secure some hotel vouchers as well to supplement the efforts being done through the cooling centers and the mass care shelter locations. So certainly it's an area that's a continued concern for the county, and we have a lot of work we have been doing and we'll continue to do with IID to try to build a more sustainable electric grid infrastructure out there that won't have these sort of significant events. So appreciate the opportunity to provide a brief report on that. Thank you.
No, thank you, Mr. Perez. That's a very significant incident that took place due to the power outage. And I'd like to thank the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians, our county, our nonprofits, and also our faith-based community for stepping forward and really helping those folks out there. And hopefully we can really, really reinforce that infrastructure, not only there, but the rest of our community as we continue to work with IID in our valley. So thank you for the report and thank you for the efforts. Do we have any further comments from committee members? Okay, I'll just give a update on the services. What I had, it was a press release. So if, once we move on to ex officio updates, if anyone has any further details, please feel free to let us know so we can have the correct information and we can get it out to the public. It says a procession and funeral will be held next week for Corporal Hunter Lopez. The procession will begin at 5 p.m. on Thursday, September 16th from Forest Lawn in Cathedral City, then travel past the Palm Desert Sheriff Station before ending at St. Francis Church in La Quinta. Members of the public are welcome to line the streets in support. Then on Friday, September 17th at approximately 9 a.m., a procession will continue from St. Francis and travel past three schools Corporal Lopez attended, which are Amelia Earhart Elementary School in Indio, John Glenn Middle School in Indio, and La Quinta High School. After the procession, the public will be able to attend a viewing at St. Francis from noon to 7 p.m. On Saturday, September 18th, a memorial service will be held at the Palm Springs Convention Center at 11 a.m. in the Oasis Room, and the Convention Center will be open to the public to watch the ceremony also on screens. Maximum capacity of public members will be 1,000 and masks are required in the Convention Center. A procession on Saturday will then travel to Riverside National Cemetery where Lopez will be laid to rest. The public is asked to remain on sidewalks and out of the road. The Riverside County Sheriff's Department plans to block and divert traffic at intersections and high traffic areas. Alternative routes for regular travel should be used during those procession times. And like I said, this is available through Desert Sun. And also if anyone from the county or Sheriff's Department is on, please feel free to give any further details. Before I move on to ex officio updates, there's something that's been brought to my attention by some of the other council members and some of the public. And I'd like to ask some of the ex officios if they could speak on this. Recently, we seen an uptick in some of the graffiti in some of our communities. And I know that the city of Indio, we have a graffiti abatement team. I'm not sure about some of the other communities. I know we spend a significant amount of funds on graffiti abatement. And as we move forward and funding is kind of tight and we're spending a lot on infrastructure, I just want to ask our ex officios, is there anything that we're doing in some of our communities to mitigate some of the graffiti? So moving along, I'll move to ex officio updates. If there are any hands raised, staff will bring you in.
Thank you, Chair. And as we're waiting for ex officios to raise their hand, I did want to acknowledge for the record that the representatives of Agua Caliente and City of Blythe are here.
Great. Thank you, Agua Caliente and Blythe, for joining us.
We do have Chief Washburn with the raised hand.
Okay, we'll go start with Chief Washburn from the City of Indio. Chief, are you there? You're muted, sir.
Okay, let's try that. So in terms of graffiti, as we all know, the faster we can get it off, the better. We have had an uptick, certainly in Indio. It sounds like everyone else is having that same sort of issue. Our graffiti team is normally two people. We're working on filling one of those positions. So trying to stay up with an uptick is a little difficult, but they do an amazing job. Just some quick updates. Indio is working on the PSEC transition, working with the engineers from PSEC and the Sheriff's Department to come out and do a deep dive of exactly what we need to do to prepare for that. And then at what stage would they be able to onboard the Indio PD and then all of our other radio partners here in the city. We're about to begin a body-worn camera test. We've had body-worn cameras for approximately 5 years. Our equipment is pretty old, pretty dated, and not up to the current standards. And so we're working on, we pushed out an RFP and we're about to begin testing of the finalists. And then we have obtained some naloxone for our folks to deploy with so that they can administer for themselves self-care as well as anyone that they run in contact with. And so we actually have an additional supply. They sent us a little too much. So we would be willing to share if someone has a need for that. That is all.
Great. Thanks, Chief. Do we have any more hands up, Steph?
I do not see any hands raised at this time.
I do have a question in regard to the graffiti removal. Is there a central number that is being used for people who've been affected by it? I know there's a number of places up and down Monterey that have been hit, and it was removed pretty rapidly. But I know some of the owners of homes are removing it themselves or painting over it themselves. So is there a central number that I can distribute? And also, about how long is it taking to have it removed or painted over?
Well, I know in the city of Indio, we do have a hotline for Indio. I'm not sure if we have a representative from Palm Desert. I believe Palm Desert is a contract city through the Riverside County Sheriff's. So if anyone's on Palm Desert on from ex officios, maybe they could speak on that if they have any information on that. But I'm pretty sure there should be a hotline.
Okay, so people should just call their own respective cities to get out the number of the hotline.
Council member, if it's helpful, we can compile some of the hotline information and have some sort of update on your next agenda. As the chair mentioned, I do believe it is city by city, but we can compile those and provide an update if there's interest among the committee in having that handy.
Yeah, and if I may.
So it's just basically city by city. Not a central number that will cover the Coachella Valley.
Correct. I had somebody who had a question.
I got a comment, Mark Carnevale here. Iris, Cathedral City has a CCPD app, and on it we have foul report, homeless, graffiti, and pertaining to the graffiti, you can take a picture of it on this app, send it right in, it goes right directly to the company. And I'm surprised, sometimes it's the same day, sometimes it's hours after it's reported. At the longest it takes is probably about 24 hours. And it's really effective. We have two apps, GoPro on Cathedral City, and then the CCPD app. And it's quite effective and it works well because we had our share of graffiti years ago. Since we put this app in, it's almost non-existent now. If it's up there a short time, but I'd recommend if you want to talk to me on it, I can show you this company, how it works a little bit later.
Okay. All right. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Great. And Erica, if we can, could we get that information and get it out to our committee members? I think that would be helpful. And we can also do an update on our next agenda.
Sure.
Great. Thank you for that. So since we don't have any more updates, I will move on to consent calendar. And that's the approved minutes from our last public safety meeting, and also receive and file an update on a continued conversation on race, diversity, and policing.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion to approve the consent calendar.
I'll second.
We got a motion by Councilmember Pena, and who is the second?
Carnevale, Cathedral City.
Cathedral City, Carnevale. Could we get a consensus vote, I guess?
I just want to abstain because I was not at that meeting.
Okay, and one abstention. by Councilmember Gardner.
Sorry, Chair. I'll also abstain as to 7A, the minutes.
Okay, another abstention by Councilmember Jacinto. Can we get a, do we have any? Someone's broken up in there. So we have a motion on the floor and a second. Could, by show of hands, could I get a consensus vote and a yes? So it looks like it passes with two abstentions. Erica, do we have a hand raised? I've seen a hand flash across the screen.
Councilmember Nunez did raise his hand. I believe he was raising his hand for the vote, though.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember.
You got it, bro.
All righty. So we'll move on to the next item, which is a discussion item, which I think is great. It's very important, and that's earthquake education and the Great California Shakeout. So, and I believe we have a presentation.
We do, Chair, and while she's preparing, I want to draw your attention. We did provide a little bit of summary information, though this is probably something you're all very well versed in terms of earthquake preparedness. Next month is the Great California Shakeout. If you participate, I know CVAC is already signed up, and with us, we do have Margaret Vinci from Caltech, and I'll let her take it away from there.
Great. Ms. Vinci, are you there?
Yeah, I just needed to unmute.
All right.
So welcome. Thank you so much for having me attend your meeting. I've been here before, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share some information, tips, and resources regarding Shakeout that you can utilize whether you're at home or at work or wherever you are on 1021. And I also want to clarify some misconceptions that there might be about Shake Alert, Earthquake Early Warning System, and encourage everybody to start using that as well. So we want to make sure all our communities are resilient to earthquake as much as possible. So first of all, the Acapulco, Mexico earthquake that we had a week ago is a reminder that we live in earthquake country and we are ever present with that threat. And of course, that was an intensive 7 of shaking. There was an alert that actually was sent, an earthquake early warning alert in Mexico was sent to Mexico City and Oaxaca because those states are far away from the epicenter, and so they did deliver that. So it is a reminder that we do live in earthquake country, and so that we do have these tools that we can use to help us to be protected from those damaging waves. So Shake Alert is the ability to provide a few seconds of warning before damaging waves hit your location. Our sensors that are scattered throughout Southern California, Oregon, and Washington can collect that ground motion when that earthquake starts. It's important to note that earthquake early warning is not a prediction. The earthquake has started. Our sensors pick up that information, send it back to Caltech at the speed of light. So at 186,000 miles per second, we know that earthquake has started. We have algorithms that then analyze that data and then trigger an alert. USGS sends the alert, but they do not deliver the alert. It's important to understand that it is private and public entities that then build the mechanism to grab that alert from the USGS and deliver it either to the public or to automated operations. And so these are things that we want to make sure that people understand so that they're properly using earthquake early warning. It's also important to understand that with each alert, it first has to hit the threshold, depending on where you are. So there may be a magnitude 7.80 in Ridgecrest, but that doesn't mean that the shaking in Palm Springs is going to be at a level 8 that it was at the epicenter. As those waves travel across the surface of the earth, they diminish in strength. And so Shake Alerts will be activated with public alerting when there is a magnitude 4.5 earthquake or it has reached the intensity 3 of shaking at your location. And this is true with phone apps, with any with our WIA system or with our Google Android phone. For automated operations, they can set their own thresholds as to when they want to trigger that automated operation. But it's important for people to understand that because some of the information out there about some of the MyShake apps or whatever are not actually telling people that it has to reach that threshold of intensity of shaking, not just magnitude. So I want to make sure they understand that so that they know that the system is working. So with Ridgecrest, that was a 7.1 earthquake. And so you can see at the epicenter, it was an intensity 7 of shaking. A shake alert was issued. But as those waves propagated outward to Palm Springs, LA County, then they diminished in strength. There were some areas, however, in Riverside and San Bernardino County that did get the alert and hit that threshold for people that were running the MyShake app, the Quake Alert app, and the WIA and the Google. So Shake Alert is meant for two per users. First of all, people to get them into protective action mode and to be able to protect them from falling objects. Also, one of the main important things that people need to understand for Shake Alert is to use it for automated operations. This is where we really are going to protect our infrastructure, to be able to slow down our trains, be able to turn off water valves, being able to start generators so that they have that electricity after the damage happens, to be able to send alerts over two-way radios to alert our safety and people that are in hazardous situations, to open gates, to open bridges. And so to use those automated operations is important. So again, public alert, we have ways of delivering that is the MyShake app, the Quake Alert USA app, and the San Diego Emergency Shake Ready app. And so people should download these, go to the Google Play, it is free. Also, WIA will push this alert at a magnitude 5, intensity 4 of shaking. And if you have a Google Android phone, it's automatically pushed through that system as well, but you have to have your notifications turned on. So again, the emphasis is on automated operations, wanting every city and county to encourage people to utilize this within our business, sending over the PA system, sending it over speakers. The windmill farms out in Palm Springs actually implemented earthquake early warning about 3 years ago. So they will automatically be set into safe mode when that earthquake, when those damaging waves happen, and also to open up fire station doors so the vehicles are not stuck inside. The message people will receive is a short tone, and then the message, earthquake, expect shaking, drop cover, hold on, protect yourself now. And when you either receive the shake alert message or you feel shaking, the protective action is to drop cover, hold on. Get under something that is going to protect you from falling objects. If you cannot do that and you're incapacitated to drop cover and hold on, sit down in a chair. If you're in a wheelchair, lock that wheelchair. Bend over, protect your inner organs. Put a book, something over your head to protect your head and your neck. If you're in bed, stay in bed. Pull the covers up over your head. Put a pillow over your head. Wait for the shaking to stop. Don't run outside. If you're in a car, pull over to the side of the road. Set your parking brake. Don't be under bridges and overpasses, but don't go driving around to find the perfect place to go. Seconds count. So when you feel shaking or you get that automatic alert, you want to take those protective actions. Know what they are ahead of time, and this is what you're going to practice in your shakeout drill. So it's important to understand when you will receive an earthquake early warning alert will be either before, during, or after shaking. If you are too close to the epicenter or where that earthquake has started, then you will not get an alert maybe till during the shaking or after the shaking. But in most cases in California, you will get a few seconds of warning to be able to get you into that safe place and to trigger automated operations. Further away you are from where that earthquake started, the more seconds you're going to have. And you can take protective actions within seconds. If you drill your plan during shakeout, you know what to do. So your body is intuitive, knows what to do. And when that shaking starts, it automatically gets you into that shake, that safe place. So some of the other earthquake tools, just as a reminder, is Shake Alert is a co-seismic tool. The earthquake is happening. It is in real time. Then seconds after that, we have evaluated all the information based on all of our 400 sensors reporting to us. We then have the accurate magnitude and intensity of shaking. Then Shake Map will then, of course, send you a map showing you where the shaking occurred so that you can make quick response decisions as to how what you're going to do after that shaking, that earthquake. And then, of course, earthquake notification. It's important to understand that earthquake notification is not earthquake early warning. They are two different things. Earthquake notification, you can sign up through the USGS or the CISN.org, that's California Integrated Seismic Network. .org. Sign up and we will send you notifications that the earthquake has happened, what the magnitude, location, and intensity of shaking of that event is. We will send you a text message and an email telling you that that earthquake has happened. But it's important to note that is not early warning. That is a separate system. Earthquake notification comes after the earthquake has happened. So it is time to drill your plan. Time to download the Shake Alert apps. Time to think about integrating PA systems, voice-activated fire alarm systems into your buildings, being able to have that redundant system of getting an alert, and trying to drill that time during shakeout. Shakeout is, of course, on October the 21st, so at 10:21 and 10:21, to then practice your drop, cover, and hold on. Wherever you are, whether it's at work or at home, many people are still at home and we want you to register. So everybody that is going to be participating in the shakeout drill, either the week before, the week after, the week of, to then register your participation at shakeout.org so that we can count everybody that is participating. So we also have some resources for you to do your drill. So if you don't quite know what to do, and we encourage people to be using video conferencing, using Zoom. So if employees, if people are still working at home, they can do this through Zoom or through video conferencing and still have that drill. Or if you're in person doing a drill, make sure that you practice COVID practices. Make sure that when you drop, cover, and hold on, you're at least 6 feet away from the person next to you and practice those as well. Media events, we usually have a big media event focused on shakeout. This year, again, it will be virtual, but we're looking for you to tell us what kind of events are happening in your neighborhood, who is doing certain things, and to go to shakeout.org to then register, and there's a place there that you can register your participation, but also tell us what events are happening in your neighborhood or in your county or in your city, so that we can then send that information to the media. They can then either contact people to see if they will do an interview and be able to then get that information out to the public and to show them what other people are doing so that they can do the same. Working at home, it is an opportunity to also drill your family, as well as if you're working at home, to work with your fellow employees by a Zoom or teleconferencing, and to identify your safe places at home. Talk about your preparedness plan with your family. We also have resources for children called Rocket Rules booklets and videos. And so you can go to our website at earthquakecountry.org, download these booklets to be able to utilize, make your children to be the proponent in the family to take care of earthquake preparedness, to find where the safe places are, to know where the emergency preparedness tools are, and to then make them the person in your family that's going to do that. Earthquake resources we have, you can go to these, again, at shakeout.org. We have them for schools, organizations, walk them through the drill, tells them what to do, how to set it up, what messages to send to their employees. And then we also have drill narrations, also tips to be able to utilize, like if you are connected and using earphones to your computer, make sure that you take those out before you drop, cover, hold on, so you're not pulling your computer off the table and now you've lost the instructions to be able to do your drill. Key talking points, the earthquakes happen at any time. Most injuries are caused by earthquakes from flying objects, so it's important to practice safety, and it's an shakeout is an opportunity to drill your plan. Our 7 steps to preparedness are also on earthquakecountry.org. To go through those with your family, with your employees, so that they are safe at home, so that they can come to work. We also have videos showing people how to do a drop, cover, hold on in different situations, in your car, in your bed, at home, outside, if there is nothing to get to an interior wall. So there's these different videos that you can utilize in your conference or your drills with people as well, handouts that you can send out ahead of time. And we also have broadcast drills. So there actually is a Shake Alert broadcast drill that you can play to alert people that earthquake is happening. And we also have drills for to be able to do your shakeout drill. Your shakeout drill will have a rumble of things falling off of shelves, and then it will tell people to drop cover and hold on. And while they're under the table, it will go through things of what they need to do while they're under the table. Then earthquake has stopped, and then what to do after that earthquake. Again, to take the how to take those protective actions, because earthquake early warning and shakeout drills aren't any good if people don't know what protective actions to take. So again, reinforcing those to be able to do that. And then these are some of the where you can connect to get these resources. And I will send these to Erica. She has a slide deck, so you have all this information to be able to utilize to send out to your constituents and to your employees and to be safe. Thank you.
Are you on there? All right, there we go. Thank you for the presentation. I had a couple of questions, but you answered them. And so I'm going to go ahead and lower my hand. And I really appreciate this presentation. We have so much going on in our world, and earthquakes are not going nowhere. They're here, right? We live in an earthquake country. And so it's always great to be proactive versus retroactive on some of these subjects. So it's a wealth of information, and we're going to get that from Erica. That's going to be great. So I have a hand up from Carnivali. He has some questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for the presentation. Very interesting. A concern that I have and a fear, what is, does the California Edison and Gas Company, do they have any kind of system in place? Because obviously if gas lines break, if electricity power lines fall, there's obviously, it's a very serious time if that happens. So do they have any programs that they're ready to do in case of this a major earthquake?
Yes, they all have response plans in place to be able to shut down gas lines at certain locations, also to be able to shut down electrical at certain locations. Obviously, you can't turn the electrical off because the wires will break because that water, that electricity is stored in those wires. The same thing with water pipes. They can't shut the whole system down, but what they can do is shut down at different locations. They actually have been using our sensors for many years. We partner with gas company, with SoCal Edison, with LADWP, with Coachella Valley Water. We partner with many of them. They host some of our sensors, our seismic sensors, and so that they do get information. But then again, earthquake early warning would even be faster than that. So being able to shut down some of those valves for critical places to be able to reduce losses and damage to that infrastructure is important, but they do have plans in place and have for several years.
And would you, I know this might be a ridiculous question, but do they have a time factor? Is it within minutes, hours, days? I mean, how quickly do they respond?
Well,
they assess an area.
Okay, so there again, it does take them time to assess an area for electricity. They can't turn it off just like that. Yeah. And so that is part of the problem. We know that we will not use earthquake early warning to turn off those utilities because it can't be done quickly. What they can do and what they is shut down certain sections that can be turned down. And so there are certain things with electrical earthquake early warning is going to be more for getting people out of dangerous situations, people that are on power poles, people that are working electrical grids, that type of thing. But shutting down electricity is not going to be feasible because it will cause other issues. The same thing with the whole water system, they can't shut it down that fast. But what they can do is shut down certain valves to reduce leakage that then causes flooding, that then causes bigger problems within their system. And this is already being done actually up in the state of Washington.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Appreciate that information.
Great. I have another hand raised from Councilmember Jacinto.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Ms. Vinci, for being here. I have a question about liquefaction. And what I understand that to mean in my very rudimentary understanding is like when the soil becomes liquefied with the water underneath it, to whatever cause, which could be caused by earthquake. I've heard it talked about in the East Valley communities in different ways as a possible risk. And I was just wondering if you had any assessment or understanding of how realistic of a risk that could be. And if so, are there any measures in place out in the East Valley where the water tables are so high to handle that?
I'm not sure what precautions have been taken at this time. I'm not sure that there can be. Liquefaction, of course, is where you have a water table. You have soft sediment on top of that. So when you have shaking, the water percolates up through the soft soil and sits on the surface. You may have had no damage to that building because of the shaking, but now you're in liquefaction and now you have a damaged building. So it is a high risk. You can go to a website, to a resource. It's called My Hazards. .caloes.ca.gov. You can then put in your address. It will tell you what your risk is for fire, for flood, for liquefaction, and for earthquake in any area in California. So I would have to look at those maps to see that. But with liquefaction, there's really not much you can do besides know that it's there. It does not mean with every earthquake you're going to have liquefaction. There has to be other factors that are in play as well. Within that area. So just because they're shaking and you live in a liquefaction area is not a guarantee you're going to have liquefaction. It is a risk to consider, but there's no guarantee. Is there anything you can do to avoid it? Unlike retrofitting your building for earthquake shaking, I have not heard anything yet for retrofitting against liquefaction.
Great, thank you. It's very true that we learn something new every day. Thank you, Councilmember Jacinto, for liquefaction. That's a new term for me. So thank you for that. And also for the record, I'd like to welcome from Palm Desert, Councilmember Cantania, and she also has a question for Ms. Vinci.
Good morning. My apologies for not making it on time. I had trouble getting the link on. But my question is actually first, if you could repeat that resource so that we can find out. You said
myhazards.caloes.ca.gov.
Thank you very much.
I think I can put it into. Nope, I don't have a chat. Okay.
Well, that's fine. We're gonna get the. All the information out to our committee members as well. So
wonderful. My question was in addition to, I saw the webs or one of the links listed was terremotos.org. Do you have additional resources in Spanish so that we can publicize these in bilingual modes, or how many of those websites are optimized, or can you recommend some that are maybe more resourceful so that we can get this critical information to a broad sector of our communities?
Almost all the resources we have from Earthquake Country Alliance, which is on earthquakecountry.org, almost all the resources that I showed very quickly on these slides are also in Spanish. Some of them are in other languages, and we are in the process of doing multiple languages. It just takes time and then, of course, funding resources to do that. But almost all of them are in Spanish now. And then, of course, the booklets that I showed for the children are in Spanish, and I think they're also in a couple of other languages as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And the 7 steps living in earthquake country is definitely in Spanish, and it is in Mandarin as well.
Wow. Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Vinci, and all the information, vital information. And I like to ask staff if we could also communicate this with the school districts. I'm pretty sure that they're doing this, but so we know the resources are going out to the community and we know it travels with our kids. So thank you for that. And this was a informational item. So I will move on to item number B, which is an update on COVID-19 public health crisis, and our county public health director will be handling this for us.
Good morning so much. Thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
Morning.
I just wanted to give a brief update on where we are with COVID-19 in the county, and then particularly in the Coachella Valley. We are sitting at a case rate right now countywide of about 28.8 cases per 100,000. We did get up as high as about 35 cases per 100,000 with this most recent surge. So we have seen the numbers start to level off and come down slightly. Although I say that with a bit of caution because we still don't know the impacts of Labor Day weekend and if we will see a jump in cases as a result of Labor Day activities. We probably won't see those cases coming in for another week to 2 weeks. So I would say that we are cautiously optimistic that our cases are starting to level out and hopefully turn the corner and come back down. In California, the case rate is 23.5 per 100,000. So the California case rate is lower than what we are seeing on a countywide basis. Our positivity rate for the county is at 7.7%. Our highest in this most recent surge in August, we got up to about 11%. So we have seen that come down a little bit. In our most vulnerable areas, or areas where they have the lowest HPI scores, which is indicative of kind of the resources that are available in the community, that positivity rate is at 8.1% for the county. Just by comparison, the state positivity statewide is at 3.9%. So we do have a higher positivity rate than the state. In terms of the Coachella Valley, we have seen the highest case rates in the cities of Indio, Coachella, and Cathedral City. In terms of deaths, we've seen the highest number of deaths in Indio, Palm Desert, and Cathedral City. And a lot of this is attributed to the age of the population, again, resources that are available, the workforce, and those types of things. In terms of positivity in the Coachella Valley, our most recent report says that the positivity is decreasing in most cities, so that's good. Again, sitting over 7%, but you know, something, even though we're starting to see them plateau and hopefully go down, they're still at a much higher rate than we would like for them to be. When we really came down from the winter surge, our positivity rate was between 1 and 2%, so significantly less than it is right now. In terms of testing, the Coachella Valley overall has had about 657,808 tests performed on residents of the Coachella Valley, which is about 18% of the total tests that have been performed, which is relatively proportional to the population in the Coachella Valley. So that's the good news. The not so great news is that in August of this year, so last month, the number of tests in the Coachella Valley decreased a bit. So overall for the county, we were seeing about 13,155 tests per 100,000. In the Coachella Valley, we were seeing about 10,850. So we definitely want to get the word out about testing. It is still important, even among vaccinated individuals, if they have symptoms or are exposed, we want them to get tested. So speaking of vaccination, in Riverside County, we have about 55% of our eligible residents are fully vaccinated. In the Coachella Valley, that number is closer to 71%, which is great. We do know that a lot of our more aging population lives in the Coachella Valley, and they were offered the vaccine first because they are at higher risk. And so there was a tremendous uptake in that population, which contributes to the overall level of immunization in the Coachella Valley. The 65 and older in the Coachella Valley have the highest vaccination rate. They're at about 88.6% fully vaccinated, which is incredible. That's a great vaccination rate. We'd still like to get it up above 90, and we're working towards that, inching up slowly every single day. We continue to see our lowest vaccination rates among our Black African-American population at 36.7% fully vaccinated, and our Latinx population at 46.7%. Many of you have heard me talk before about our partnerships that we have with our community-based organizations. Amazing groups that are working throughout the county, but particularly in the Coachella Valley and the Eastern Coachella Valley, to really do targeted outreach to those populations that are at high risk, but also the most hesitant to get vaccinated. So we have folks that are part of the community that are out doing outreach, doing education, hosting vaccination events, hosting testing events, really trying to get to reach those communities and get our numbers up in those communities so that they are also protected. And then lastly, just wanted to mention very briefly about children. So we are seeing the number of cases increase in children. You may have seen some national news on this. So nationwide, statewide, we are seeing the numbers increase in children. There are some theories about why that may be happening. Probably the most plausible one is the fact that we have a large population of our children. Everybody under 12 years old is not eligible for vaccination currently. And so if you have a virus that is looking for a susceptible host, That is a susceptible host, and it's a large number of people that are susceptible. So we actually are going to be releasing a report on children infections in children later this week. So we'll make sure we get that out to the group. But we are seeing, just to give you an idea, between June and August, we saw about 2,110 cases in children that were 12 to 17 year olds. So those are children who are eligible for vaccination. 60 of them occurred in vaccinated children. So 97% of those cases occurred in children that are not vaccinated. So again, our message continues to be that these vaccines are safe, they are effective. There is a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccines, about their efficacy. Can you still get infected after you get vaccinated? Yes, but your chances of being hospitalized and dying from the virus are greatly, greatly diminished. So it is, the vaccines are safe, they're effective. We encourage people to get vaccinated, and we're gonna continue to work with all of our partners in the community to get as many people vaccinated as possible. And with that, I'll stop. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are.
Great, thank you for that information. And I appreciate it that it's real straightforward and clear, because I think there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of messaging going on out there. And it's important that we give our public facts so they could base their, opinions or options or, you know, on what they want to do to keep their families safe and keep our community safe. So I appreciate that. With that, Councilmember Cantania has her hand raised. She has a question.
Thank you. My question is in regards to the number of children that were affected. You said between June and August, there was 2,100 cases. Out of the cases that are currently active, or actually out of the hospitalizations, unfortunately, how many of those are children? I think a lot of people are still thinking it's not a big deal, kids are healthy, but I've seen nationwide a trend, and Riverside County did have, I believe, a four-year-old. So out of respect for all of the families that are in that heart-wrenching decision of sending their kids to go back or not go back, or vaccinations when they're available, how many children do we currently have hospitalized with COVID?
That's a great question, council member. And we are actually in the process of vetting that data right now. There's a little bit of a challenge in collecting hospitalization data and discerning whether or not children are, or anybody is hospitalized for COVID, or if they were hospitalized for something else and tested for COVID. And so we want to be very clear that the data are clear and that we are capturing people who are actually hospitalized for COVID. So the staff has been working with the EMS agency and all of the hospitals to collect that data. And we should be releasing that later this week. So I actually don't know the exact number, but I can say that you are absolutely correct. We have seen an increase in children that have been hospitalized. And we did have a death in a four-year-old. We've had two deaths in 17-year-olds. And you know, the four-year-old is a perfect example of being a death that was preventable. There were no prior conditions known in the death of that child. So an absolute tragedy. We are hopeful, I didn't mention this, we are hopeful that the vaccine will be authorized for children 5 to 11 years old in October. Pfizer has been collecting data, doing their studies, and will be submitting for emergency use authorization. And so that should hopefully go through sometime in October, and then we'll start rolling out to those ages. And then I think Moderna will probably be not too far behind, so that there will be some options for that age group hopefully soon. And then also, I'm very sorry, I forgot to mention the hospitalization data in general in the desert. And so just really quickly, we are seeing still a large percentage of hospital beds being utilized right now. In the region, the desert region as a whole, we have 88 COVID positive individuals hospitalized. But if we look at bed utilization across the system, Desert Regional and Eisenhower are both upwards of 90%. In terms of ICU utilization, Desert Regional's at 94%. Eisenhower's at 92%. JFK is a little bit lower, but from what I understand, they're having some staffing issues. So they're trying to work through those. Palo Verde Hospital has submitted a request or has notified us that they're going to be submitting a request for staffing support. So we're working on that with them. But just by comparison, in the southwest part of the county, they are over 100% ICU utilization. So these are not all because of COVID. It's just as a system and for all causes. We do have a very busy hospital system. And the impact when we have COVID on top of that is we have fewer beds available if somebody has an emergency and needs a hospital bed. So again, the way to help with that is to get vaccinated, wear a mask, protect yourself and your community as much as possible.
Great, okay. Thank you. We have another
question. I just have one question in regard to children being struck by either COVID or testing positive. When you collect the data, will you be able to give out information in regard to how children are actually being affected? Are they getting very sick? Are they just being treated at home? Are they just cold symptoms? What exactly are children experiencing? And how are their families also being affected? And are they being transmitted the virus also from one to another?
Yeah, those are great questions. So we do follow up on cases that occur among children. So any child that tests positive that is reported to us at the health department, we do reach out and try to get in touch with the family so that we can ascertain what is going on in the household. Are there other people that may have been sick? Was the child participating in extracurricular activities where they may have been exposed, or what was the source of exposure? We only get information probably less than 50% of the time. Oftentimes families either don't respond to our calls or are hesitant to give us information, which really limits our ability to trace and get to the bottom of the questions that you are asking. What we will be able to do with the data that we have though is differentiate between kids who tested positive and were a case of COVID-19 and those who were hospitalized. So kind of both ends of the spectrum. We don't capture in a consistent way the severity of the illness. There's just the surveillance systems that exist today are not set up to capture the severity and the different kinds of illness that may be occurring.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Great, thank you. We have another question from Councilmember Jacinto.
Thank you, Chair. First, I wanted to just raise up the fact that the Far East Valley communities have really high vaccination rates. And I think I saw a report saying the residents of the city of Mecca are nearly 100% vaccinated. And I just think that's an incredible statistic that must reflect a lot of the efforts put into the outreach in the East Valley and to farm workers in particular. And also commending the residents themselves for, you know, informing themselves and recognizing what the risks are to their families and their communities and the importance of vaccination. So that's been a really bright point, I guess you could say, in this terrible drawn out pandemic. I did have a question following up on the issue of children, which is at the top of everyone's mind lately. You know, seeing the increasing numbers being reported out of the schools in the local school districts and everywhere, but speaking locally, there's an assumption or there's a conclusion that those are slightly underreported even, but they're still alarming. And so I'm just curious if you know, Kim, or if anyone knows, to what extent the county or the state have been talking about re-implementing some of the distance learning options that were available last year that are no longer available in order to cut those down or to create safer spaces for students and families.
Thank you for that question. So schools are definitely an area that we've put a lot of resources and focus on. And just so the group is aware, we do at the county have a team that is focus just on the school response. So they work with the schools across the county on a regular basis in terms of contact tracing support, recommendations for safety, and all of those types of things. On top of that, we also have done in the last 2 weeks, we've done a handful of seminars for the schools where we've talked through kind of protocols and best practices. Dr. Leung, our public health officer, and I meet on a regular basis every other week with the school superintendents and answer questions and work with them. So all of that is just to say that we do have a really close relationship with the schools, and we do a lot of one-on-one outreach and education and working with them. And I will tell you, hands down, the schools are all committed to creating a safe environment and maintaining a safe environment for their students. There has not been one school where I've said, oh my gosh, I'm really worried about that population. So numbers are there, right? What we don't know is, are kids getting exposed in school, or are they getting exposed at home or in other areas and bringing it into the school? It is likely a combination of both. I am not hearing the state signal at all that they are looking at going back to distance learning. I think that their priority is that we keep children in school and keep them as safe as possible. So having said that, it does put a lot of work and a lot of onus on the schools to do the contact tracing, to make sure that if children are exposed, they're put on modified quarantine, also that everybody inside is wearing masks. And so that really requires not only school effort, but community effort to make sure that we're helping the schools and supporting them as they're trying to keep a safe environment for schools. And from the county's perspective, Juan certainly can speak to this as well, but the county's priority has been also to continue to work with the schools and keep kids in school so that they can get the most benefit from the education system and all the supports that come in the school environment.
Thank you.
Great. We got another question from Councilmember Catania.
Yes, my question is actually, I have two questions. Number one is, everybody finds it very helpful when you're able to release the statistics of how the hospitals are doing and measuring. When will we be able to see that data by school district? I think parents really need to know where they can see the protocols and how they're going. There's also a lot of concerns from parents in regards to the process and the timeline for notifications. When I've seen a lot of parents saying, my kid, I just got a letter say on Friday saying my kid was exposed on Monday, and they can't say who it is, of course, for confidentiality. So how does a student know I sat next to my friend who is now sick and can't come to school, or we played tetherball or whatever it is? I know there's modified activities, but we need to know how and how soon, because parents want to have their kids feel safe. I see so many parents on the message boards, tell me how to get my kid into distance learning. Parents are scared. Just as many parents that are even for vaccinations, it's not even a political issue. There's parents that are concerned about the notification timeline. So how can we let parents know what is the best process? What can they expect out of the school districts in case the school district is not following the protocols that are expected of them? And what resources do parents have in order to make the safest decisions for sending their kids?
Councilmember, those are a lot of questions. I would go back to the fact that we are working really closely with the schools. There are some challenges with reporting and notification. And if you can imagine the process, a child has to test positive. The family has to notify the school, right, that they tested positive, unless they test positive through a school surveillance testing program. From there, the school has to do their assessment and then make the appropriate notifications. School districts vary in terms of the notifications that they make. Some schools will notify everybody and say, if your child was exposed, you will receive a separate notification. Some schools will only notify children that were exposed. And then other schools, the other one that I've seen is they'll notify everybody in the classroom or classrooms if it's a multi-class exposure. But again, say, if your child was exposed, then we will notify you separately. One of the things that tends to happen because the schools are very busy trying to do the contact tracing is we are seeing schools cast a fairly wide net in terms of exposures. So we're really working with the schools to narrow their focus so that, if there is an exposure, we're doing a really lengthy investigation to try to get to who was truly exposed, to try to minimize some of that fear and anxiety that's happening. It depends on the amount of resources in the school district. It depends on timeliness of notification, timeliness of reporting, timeliness of reaching out to us. So there are a lot of places where things can have a timeline extended. I would say that more often than not, we are notified on the tail end of the 10-day period, just because of all the processes that are occurring. And the 10-day period I'm referring to is a quarantine period. right? So if I was to give advice to parents, I would say be very familiar with your school or your district's reporting protocols, how that's happening, who's doing the case investigation, how they're working with the health department, and what is their method of communication and notification to parents. And really, you know, help the school as much as possible with, if your child is sick, call it in, let the school know. If your child tests positive, call it in right away, let the school know, so that those wheels can start to turn on a quicker basis so that we can get everybody who may have been exposed notified.
So our chair lost connection just briefly, but we're expecting him back in shortly. In the meantime, I do see that Councilmember Gardner's hand is up.
Thank you. My question is related to how is it that not all students in a classroom would be notified of exposure? How, you know, for instance, in a work environment, people who work in the same office, when there's not clear divisions, would all be notified of possible exposure. So why are the children, not all of the parents being notified if their children were in the same classroom?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I will say that that is the exception in terms of how schools are doing it. Most schools are notifying at least the classroom, if not the entire school. But there are situations where exposures are very limited. And so it could be that there is, for example, a certain kind of teacher that's coming in to support the main teacher, like doing some focused work with a group of kids. Maybe it was that teacher who was positive, and so she was only around that specific group of kids and not the entire classroom. And maybe she was, so there is a study actually out of Marin County that shows there was a positive teacher, and it looked at the kind of exposure patterns in the classroom. And what they found is that it was really kids in the first two rows of the class who were exposed and infected because the teacher was pulling down her mask to read. And so the kids that were sitting in the back of the class were not exposed and did not get infected. So the only way that we would have really focused notification like that is if we could really drill down with confidence on where that person was and who they interacted with. If there's any doubt in that, then the notification would be more broad.
Okay, so seeing that Chair Furman has not yet been able to reconnect, I can resume.
I have a question, because, you know, with the comments about, you know, parents being so concerned, and we're a pretty small valley, and yes, we do have a number of different school districts. Everybody has got an iPhone. Everybody. You may not have a house computer, but okay, I know you're shaking your head, so apparently not everybody does, but it seems strange to me that someone would be, I guess, diagnosed on a Monday and people don't get notified until Friday. It really, for those people who do have an iPhone, and I know it's hard to weed through and say who is really exposed and who isn't exposed, but if there's a lapse time between a Monday and a Friday, you know, between e-blasts and iPhone contacts, it just seems a little strange to me that it would take so long to have parents, especially since they are so concerned. And that's as a very controversial issue, you know, whether or not kids should be into school and whether or not they should be in school with a mask on. But if someone is found to be positive, it just seems strange to me that more rapid notification doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, I think.
Or am I reading it wrong?
No, you're not reading it incorrectly. It varies significantly from school to school, from district to district. I can tell you that a lot of schools have put in practices to do those notifications over the weekends. They are giving incentive pay to have staff work over the weekends. Our teams work over the weekends. So I think we're getting better. It was just kind of that initial flood of people coming back to school. But there is a very real delay in terms of the timeliness of reporting that does come into play. And so it just has to, we have to narrow the reporting windows so that we can get those notifications out as quickly as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm back on. I'm having some internet issues with my laptop, so it's resetted. But I'm going to try to navigate this on here. Erica, can you update me where we're at?
Sure, Chair. We've been having a conversation, obviously, about children vaccination rates, and Council Member Quintanilla does have her hand up in case you can't see that.
Okay, Council Member, you can go ahead while I continue to work on this.
Sounds good. Thank you. My last question is in regards to, again, worst case scenario. We're looking forward and we're getting vaccines rolled out for kids. But again, worst case scenario, what would it take for us to have to go back to distance learning? We really want to keep it very far away. But if that's how we can let parents know to vaccinate their kids, because we know parents don't want to go back to distance learning. So what is the metric that would determine that so we can let people know we have to stay far away from that?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you, council member, but the state has not put out a metric that is, you know, a threshold where if we get to this level, then we will go to distance learning. I think that all the resources and the focus has been on keeping it safe and building safety protocols and helping schools and getting funding out to them. So there is not a metric in place.
Thank you. Does that answer all of our questions so far? Yes. Okay, well, I just have one question. When is that report coming out? You said later this week?
Yes, later this week.
Okay, I think that's going to be vital to help us move forward and keep answering questions. And I just have my internet issue. We just got to keep adapting to keep all of our families safe, and especially our children. So I want to thank you for that report and that information. And also the information is available on the website, correct?
Yes, it is.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. That is an informational item. So we'll now move to 8C, which is election of public safety officers, which will be handled by Mr. Tom Kirk.
Good morning, committee members. It's that time of year again, and you're all talking about distance learning. We've of course been doing virtual meetings. It's been an unusual year for all of us. In some ways easier to have meetings, in some ways, as your chair just realized, more difficult. We're relying on connection speeds and everything else. There's no policy on the chairmanship. We only had 5 meetings of the Public Safety Committee last year. Your current chair is Wayman Furman. Your current vice chair is Megan Beeman Jacinto. The pleasure of the committee, open for nominations.
Well, I'll start by saying thank you for allowing me to chair this year. It's been a difficult year with all the things that we have going on, but this is my passion in public safety. So it was an honor to chair. And if I so have the honor to chair for another year, I will be willing to do that gracefully. So thank you.
Do we have any nominations?
Mr. Chair, I'll make a nomination that we keep our officers as is for another year.
All right. We have a nomination. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All right. Are there any other nominations? Then we'll consider the nominations closed, and the maker of the motion and the second will be to reelect the chair and vice chair for another year. Is there anybody opposed? Thank goodness. It's unanimous. Congratulations.
Well, yay. I thank you all, and I look forward to continuing to working with everybody. Hopefully it's safe and we can meet in person. I have a lot of other things I like to work on in the community, especially with the vice chair. And so just thank you all, and looking forward to another year, a safe year moving forward. So thank you, Mr. Kirk, for that. And we'll move on to item number 9, which is information. And that's our attendance record, which is in the packet. So if you want to look at that. Item number 10 is public comments on non-agenda items. And this time is in places for members of the public to address Public Safety Committee on items of general interest that are not on the agenda. Do we have any public comments, Erica?
We did not receive any before the meeting, and I do not see any hands raised.
Okay, thank you. I'd just like to add a request to staff for a future meeting, maybe not the next one, if we could reach out to our ex officials and see if there's any training or any anything we could add on our agendas on active shooting. I know that's something that's prevalent in our communities. And I'd like to see if we have some training. The earthquake information kind of reminded me of some of these technologies that we have at our hand. And I think looking into something like that for active shooter situations in our community would be important. So if we could canvas our resources for that, I would appreciate it. Moving forward to item number 11, which is announcements, our upcoming meetings. The next meeting for the Public Safety Committee will be held on Monday, November 8th, 2021 at 9 a.m. Either via Zoom webinar or in person pending the state's guidance and finalization of logistics. The next meeting of the Executive Committee will be held Monday, September 27th, 2021 at 4 p.m. via Zoom webinar. Before I adjourn the meeting, do we have any comments from our committee or ex officios?
Just one comment. You've done a great job, and it's always a pleasure seeing everyone, especially seeing everyone healthy. So we look on forward to a healthier year, hopefully, but I want to just thank everybody for all your efforts, working with your cities and working with your officials. It's been delightful. We're doing the best we can.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes. Do
that. Thank you for the opportunity to make a comment. I also wanted to sort of commend everyone on the committee. I think the last year, aside from being one of the most challenging years probably of all of our lives, also was a really productive year for this committee. In the 2 or 3 years that I've been on it, I'm seeing it being increasingly engaged and increasingly active in public safety issues, which I think is really important and beneficial to our region as a whole. So thank you everyone for continuing to participate with such dedication and attention to the issues. I also wanted to request for any of the ex officios that are still listening and also for the committee members, if we could get back to the ex officio reporting that we did pre-pandemic when we were in person, where each city or each region would report out significant events and issues and trends. I think that would also be beneficial. I really miss that, even if it doesn't seem like, you know, something all that big or new. I did like hearing place by place how law enforcement was doing, for lack of a better term. If it's possible to return to that, I would really like to see it.
Yes, thank you, Councilmember, and I second that. I think that's very important. I think the Zoom kind of makes it hard for some of us sometimes with a lot of things going on, but we'll reiterate that in the future as well. Hopefully it'd be in person. Councilmember Campania.
Yes, my quick comment was just to say my deepest gratitude to staff that was available to present such detailed, comprehensive metrics that let us know where we stand, where we are in comparison. So again, just deepest gratitude to staff that presented and all of the staff involved in compiling the data. We see the brief presentation, but just we're all trying our best. We're all struggling, and just thanks to everybody.
Thank you. And I don't see any further hands raised. I just like to make one further comment before I adjourn the meeting. I just want to ask everyone to keep us Lance Corporal Salvador Luli in your prayers. He's still recovering from the attacks in Afghanistan. One of our local soldiers, he's recovering. So we want to keep him and his family in prayer. And also the family members of Hunter Lopez, and also all the soldiers, keep their families in prayer, keep our community in prayer and our country. So with that being said, I'll adjourn this meeting at 10:18 a.m. Thank you.
Thank you.